Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters, our new Saturday morning agricultural news program. Let me introduce you to your host, farm broadcaster Ken Root from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Hello and welcome. I have some news. This is our last show in 2018. It's the dreaded year end or year beginning where we have to learn to write a new date on the line of a check. It's also a time to put the past behind us and begin looking at the year ahead. A time for resolutions that only 8% of us will keep for the full year. The biggest news in agriculture this year was passage of the 2018 Farm Bill. It was not guaranteed to happen. The leadership of the Senate seemed to steer the House away from the brink, and the Democratic leader of the House Ag Committee was more in the middle of the road than the Republican chairman. AgriPulse gave me permission to air an interview between Senate Ag Committee Chairman Pat Roberts and their reporter Spencer Chase.
Obviously a very busy man. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. It's a privilege for me.
Well, I understand hearing that the Senate Agriculture Committee and the House Agriculture Committee have worked together to pass the 2018 Farm Bill. You're probably feeling a little bit better this week than you were a week or two ago.
I think that's a very accurate statement.
I want to read you off a couple of quotes. In mid-November, you said, "Three of us think we have a very good farm bill, and I'm very troubled by the fact that we can't get an agreement among three, but can't go to the fourth." And Chairman Conaway over in the House said, "They've got to change their mind on stuff that is unacceptable. I've got responsibilities to act on behalf of the House and get what we want out of the bill."
Mm-hmm.
How did we go from there to here with the bill passed?
We did and he didn't.
There's got to be more to it than that. I mean,
No, there's always more to it than that. Mike, strong advocate for what he believes in, what he thought would represent a good Republican bill. But in the Ag Committees down through the years, it's always been bipartisan. Even when we had Freedom to Farm that I did way back in 96, that was revolutionary. This was evolutionary. But it didn't mean that we didn't have strong differences of opinion on what should be in the bill and what shouldn't. And we had agreement with three, and Mike, since he had done a Republican bill that passed by two votes, but we had a bill that passed by 86, and then 87 finally, and then an overwhelming vote in the House, both set records. And it just shows you what you can do if you keep working at it and get a bipartisan bill. The other part of it was that policy is important, and I understand that, and I respect that on anybody that has any kind of an ideological view or a policy view. But in the end, you have to count votes. And we had to have 60. And Democrats are voting as a block these days. So I don't know how I could have carved out another 20 Democrats to vote for something that would have been different, more especially with nutrition, than what we have. And what we have, by the way, I think I'm very proud of, because I think it is a more comprehensive effort that really will result in better and greater program integrity. But the one we have now, I think, is a good bill. I think it addresses the current need. We're in a rough patch with agriculture, and I think everybody in agriculture understood that. This bill has the support of virtually every farm organization, every commodity group. Over 1,000 different organizations have endorsed this bill because of what they see out there, and they needed certainty and predictability. Those two things topped any other agenda that somebody might have.
I know, obviously, going back to some of the comments that I read off earlier, and I know you probably have some other ones in your mind as well, but at any point throughout this process, did you legitimately question if we were going to see a 2018 Farm Bill?
No.
Why is that?
Because Senator Stabenow and Senator Roberts and I know that Colin Peterson over in the House, the ranking member, soon to be chairman, and then Mike Conaway, we wanted a bill. But there was considerable discussion, to say the least, with regards to some of the policies, some of the titles, particularly nutrition and the commodity title. And conservation was another one. We discussed those quite a bit, to say the least. And we knew that we had to have an accord. I think the problem came, for me at least, is that when there was a difference of opinion, and then we would send back another proposal, and then it would take, unfortunately, a lot of time for that to get back, and time we did not have. So we were able to shorten that up and reaching an accord. This was not a revolutionary farm bill. It was evolutionary on purpose, and that's what we heard at all the hearings. We did exactly what farmers have told us, all regions, all crops, everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you mentioned the big sweeping votes that we saw in the House and the Senate, unanimous support from Democrats in the Senate and all but, I believe, three in the House.
Yeah.
But what we saw in terms of the level of bipartisan support, and particularly the support from the Democratic Party, do you think the Farm Bill Coalition that folks so much rely upon to get this bill passed, do you think it has expanded to a certain point that could be permanent? Do you have a sustainable level of an expanded coalition because of this bill, do you think?
Anybody who talks about permanency in the U.S. Congress or the Senate might want to think about that a little bit. We are right now in the midst of just the opposite of what we achieved in the Farm Bill. People say, how'd you do that? Well, we just kept working at it. That was the exception, not the rule. Not pointing fingers, but we've pulled the string of comedy pretty far here in the Senate, and I deeply regret that. There was a time, we did it in the tax bill, but the tax bill got very partisan. This was not a partisan bill, and we were able to do that by reaching an accord. The Democrats respected Stabenow. I hope the Republicans respected me, and I think that was true. Once Mike came aboard, they respected him. They respected what he had to do to get a bill. And the same thing with Colin. And they knew we'd work awful hard, and they knew about the rough patch that farmers are in. So if you have that going for you, and you have over 1,000 organizations, I said I would ride point, and I didn't want to turn around and not see anybody in the ranks. There were a lot of people in the ranks. And we had great staff. Staff learned to work with one another, and would tell us where we thought we could make some progress and maybe some other areas where we couldn't. We had a great effort from a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm. Does the vote totals, the level of bipartisan support that you got, does that say anything to you about whether or not this could or should be the last farm bill?
When I voted for my first farm bill, I've done eight of them. On that first bill, we heard the same catcalls. Well, this can be a last farm bill. They're just too tough. And it was always about the coalition between the nutrition folks and folks that work awful hard to make sure those who need it the most get a good diet, and that this coalition somehow would fracture. There's been some efforts that would have seen that happen, but each time we've been able to put it together. No, this is not the last farm bill. I mean, my goodness, you're talking about what, 1/6 the economy or more, the ability for Americans to have the best quality food at the lowest price in the history of the world, and to be a tremendous factor with regards to national security, with regards to our trade situation, if we can get that straightened out, and I hope we can. It's too important, so you got to have a farm bill.
Mr. Chairman, appreciate you joining us.
You bet.
Thanks to AgriPulse for allowing me to play that interview with Senator Roberts. If you're interested in tracking agribusiness news from Washington, AgriPulse is a great source. It's a subscription-based service on the Internet. You can get a trial subscription at AgriPulse, that's AGRI-PULSE.com. Meanwhile, back in Iowa, we have some interesting issues as well. A new soybean pest is invading fields and doing major damage. It's called the soybean gall midge. Anna Hastert has been following it closely. Also, an update on hog farm nuisance lawsuits in North Carolina. What's the connection? North Carolina is the second largest hog-producing state in the nation. Iowa is number one. This is Weekend Ag Matters on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
More than ever, it's critical to take advantage of favorable grain prices when you see them, even when your crop is still in the field. You can when you have a thoughtful crop revenue plan with Farm Credit Services of America. Our crop insurance officers have the expertise to deliver a plan that can help you lock in those crop prices, protect your income, and your working capital too. We'll show you how. Learn more by calling Farm Credit Services of America. Agriculture works here.
Crop specialists at your local FS company know agronomy, soil types, and genetics. We're also dedicated to your success. So in the end, we're more than crop specialists. We're do-whatever-it-takes specialists. We're walk-a-mile-in-your-boots specialists. We're let's-do-this-thing specialists.
FS Envision and FS High Soy are bringing success in Iowa yield trials near you. Talk to your FS crop specialist.
Now, here again is Weekend Ag Matters host, Ken Root.
Dustin Hoffman joins me on the line this morning, and Dustin, let's talk about these recent lawsuits in North Carolina that have to do with the swine industry. As I understand it, they are basically going against Smithfield Foods, but having to pass through and file suit against small producers who are raising hogs for Smithfield Foods, and they're nuisance lawsuits. What does that mean?
Well, Ken, the nuisance lawsuits are basically about smell or about the flies, you know, about the minor inconveniences that sometimes happen when you're living near a hog facility. And as you said, they're targeting farmers who have operations that are growing for Smithfield Foods, and that seems to be the target. They haven't gone against any individual independent farmers. It's always been against Smithfield Foods.
Now, we reported a while back that there had been four lawsuits, I think, that had come to a conclusion. The three were under one judge with very large punitive damages, but the fourth turned out differently. What's the story on those?
Well, as you said, Ken, the first three came out very, very large attacks. We got into it after the third verdict came down against a farm called HD3 Farms in North Carolina. They saw punitive damages somewhere in the neighborhood of around $400 million.
Oh, my gosh.
But the thing is, they have a law in North Carolina limiting punitive damages to only about $200,000, I believe, is what the number is. I'd have to look that up for sure. So the thing is, a lot of these damages, the amounts will be thrown out. But this has been going on with the judge. And what's been causing the problems is the fact that he was not allowing any of the juries to go out to the farms to even look at them, because he said just because you picked one day doesn't mean it's representative of all the other days. Now, in the fourth trial, I should say, now that we've been watching, it's been a new U.S. District Judge, David Faber, and he also did not let the juries go out, but he also severely limited the punitive damages against Smithfield in this fourth lawsuit. Instead of seeing millions and millions of penalties handed out, because the first three together came out to about $550 million in penalties total. And this last trial, they only saw compensations of $75,000 for like the closest neighbor, but other neighbors that were filing in the lawsuit only received $100. So when it was all said and done, there was eight plaintiffs in this last case. The two closest neighboring homes received $75,000 and $25,000 respectively. There were two $1,000 awards and four $100 awards. And when you look at a lawyer who's taking about 40% of the winnings as a fee plus expenses, those people that only got $100, they're not going to be able to pay for the expenses of a lawyer on $60.
Well, that's really the gist of this, isn't it? That the lawyers were probably recruiting people so they could sue and the law firm could make money, and the people thought they could make money, or perhaps their only goal was to get rid of the hog farms. But if it's not in the best interest economically for a law firm, do you think they will then slide away from doing this?
It's going to be interesting to tell, because there are appeals processes going on in the first three trials to begin with against the first judge. But the problem is he has not signed off on any of the paperwork that needs to go to the appellate court yet. The farmers that are involved in that case, talking with them, they're under the impression that he's probably going to wait until the absolute last minute before he has to send that paperwork off. And because they're expecting, hopefully, that the next appellate court up will probably overturn this. That appellate court has already overturned gag orders against people involved in those cases in the first three especially the Smithfield food executives and the owners of the hog farms. They were under gag order until the appellate court said there's no reason that they should be under a gag order during the appeals process. So that's going to be a wait-and-see thing there. But now the next set of lawsuits that go to trial come up this next month in January, and the first judge is back on that one. So the farmers that are going into this one are a little more nervous again, because this is the judge that has thrown the book at them, or thrown the pocketbook at them at Smithfield. But again, they're waiting for appeals courts to maybe set some kind of precedence against these and maybe hopefully shut it down. But again, it's a lot of waiting through this situation.
Do I understand that once the verdict was final, the hog farms had to be vacated?
Yes, and that's the unfortunate part of this right now. All the hog farms are immediately vacated within, I believe, 24 hours after the verdicts are come down. They're found to be a nuisance. Now, of course, this is considered a temporary setback, because what they have to do is that they have to come into compliance with, you know, they have to be inspected by the state and by federal, you know, agencies, just like you would be when you set up a hog facility. And basically, the once that process has been gone through, they can start the process of bringing hogs back in. But during that time, you have many facilities that are out of hogs, many workers who are working for these facilities that have nothing to do and who are relying on those paychecks. And I know when I talked with the managers at HD3 Farms this summer, they were more worried about their employees and the livelihoods of their employees and their families than they were about the setback they had. And they had justifiable right to be upset over these lawsuits, but they were more concerned about what it was going to mean for their employees.
Well, the last thing is Iowa. We have more hogs than does North Carolina. And if this type of lawsuits came in here, I could only think that foot and mouth disease would be a worse plague on those farmers.
Exactly. And that's what I know a lot of Iowa producers have been watching, and producers in all states have been watching, because North Carolina is the second largest hog producing state to Iowa. And if it can happen there, it could easily happen in Iowa. And this lawyer that is recruiting these plaintiffs against the hog facilities is going after Smithfield, and he's doing this. He's coming from Texas to do this. So his whole goal is to travel around and make a name for himself doing these lawsuits and get these big verdicts and collect these big fees. However, Smithfield, talking with the last farmer that was involved in this last trial, Smithfield has got a lawyer now who is also from Texas, who made it her mission to follow this lawyer around, because apparently she just enjoys making life a little difficult for him.
My goodness, this sounds like it could go on for a long time with no really good outcome for anybody.
Yes, it's going to basically come down to what the appellate courts decide to do. I mean, basically, it's up to them to basically put an end to this before it gets out of hand. And, of course, with the cases that are still upcoming in North Carolina are going to be going to the judge who likes to award huge punitive damages. It's up to him to get those cases forwarded on to the appellate courts so they can be ruled on.
Dustin Hoffman, who follows news every day for us on this station and on our network across Iowa. Dustin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
In a moment, a look at a new threat to soybeans, an insect that we don't yet know how to control. This is Weekend Ag Matters. Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Well, if you're a soybean grower, you're concerned now about whether or not you're going to have a market in 2019, as China is still not sure how many soybeans they're going to buy from the United States. But now there's an insect problem that is in the state of Iowa that's a new one to deal with. Anna Hastert joins us, who's our digital editor and farm broadcaster. Anna, you really got into keeping track of this soybean gall midge. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right, Ken. This pest has really sparked my interest, and here's what I know about it so far. So the soybean gall midge is a new species of the midge. And because it's a new species, entomologists, researchers don't really know much about it, which has presented a lot of problems. But, I mean, it's a new species and it's new, but this isn't the first time that we've seen it in Iowa. It's also in Nebraska and South Dakota. But in 2011, we received the first report of the soybean gall midge in Nebraska. That was kind of it. It was a little bit of an isolated report. Didn't hear much more after that. Then 4 years later, in 2015, we received isolated reports from eastern South Dakota, eastern Nebraska, and then northwest Iowa. So that's the first time that it was actually confirmed in Iowa, was in 2015. And since 2015, it's really made a presence in the state. So in 2016 and 2017, more reports of injury were coming in from all three states. And then in 2018, this past growing season, there was a widespread infestation and economic injury noted in 65 counties. Now, that's not 65 counties in Iowa. It was actually confirmed in 18 counties in Iowa this past growing season. So really making a presence here. And we're just kind of watching to see if it's going to move further across the state and will affect more of Iowa's 99 counties, or if it'll stay isolated to those 18 counties currently, but really, really big in regards to economic damage caused by this pest.
Well, Anna, what kind of damage does it do to the plant? And if you would, in what part of the growing season does it hit?
Yeah, so the pest is actually believed to overwinter in our fields. They haven't confirmed that, but that's what it's looking like so far. And as far as when it actually impacts crops, it looks to be maybe early June is when it first starts. And this pest is really hard to detect. It's very, very small. You almost need a hand lens to go up to your plant and look at it to actually see it on your plant. So farmers who are used to just driving by their crop fields to see if they have damage, that's not going to cut it this next year. You're going to need to actually get out of your truck or whatever vehicle you're driving and go into those fields to look in depth at those plants to see if this pest is here. And basically, once you have the infestation, that's it. It's really going to go to town and do the work that and damage that it does. And the damage is catastrophic. Usually it sticks to the edges of fields, which is very interesting. It can be found in the middle of fields, but it'll only impact those edges of fields as far as we know so far. And like I said, the effects are truly damaging. I attended a conference about the soybean gall midge in Lewis, Iowa, a couple weeks ago, and I heard from farmers that farm there in southwest Iowa that they had to mow down the edges of their crop fields because once that soybean gall midge got on their plants, it just took everything out. There's absolutely no yield that you can reap from that crop. It's just completely dead.
Wow, sounds like a grasshopper infestation moving in. Well, let's talk about control. Is there any means of control or is there research underway?
Well, since it's a new species, we still don't know much about the pest. So there's really no good measures for control as of this point. We've had some farmers that have tried corn soybean rotations. They've also tried cover crops, different chemicals. Nothing has proven to really have a good control over this pest. Some of those practices may have a little bit of an impact, but not good enough to get complete control over the pest. So heading into the new crop season, Iowa State University researchers are going to be looking at this. They're going to be doing some trials within their research farms. And then they're also, and then Iowa Soybean Association is also looking for farmers to participate in a study to find a good control method. So the Iowa Soybean Association study is all about finding that control method. They're going to try a couple different practices there on the edge of the field. And so if you're interested in participating in that, you have a soybean gall midge infestation on your farm within past crop seasons, then definitely reach out to the Iowa Soybean Association so they can hopefully find a good control measure here soon.
Called soybean gall midge, and Anna's been following that on the network, and you'll continue to do so. Let's hope we find a way to deal with it. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thanks, Ken.
that wraps up our show for this week and this year. Keep track of us on our website, iowaagnet.com, and Monday through Friday on our 53 affiliate stations across the state. Also, my advice about this coming Monday night, New Year's Eve. It's amateur night. People who don't know what they're doing do things that get them in trouble, and sometimes they get others in trouble as well. I know that from experience. It's a good night to come home early or just stay home and watch it on TV. Weekend Ag Matters is a production of the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.